which they would have lost the Battle of Britain without any question.
Would you have anything to do with this at all?
No, we were learning a bit about them and we knew about them, but nobody, they were always referred to as those them theirs, because they were still very, very secret, all the way down, very secret there. And you didn't talk about them anywhere, not even amongst yourself much. And the radar for guns all came along a little later. And once the first radar was found and set up and working, it began to be adapted for all sorts of things, as you well know.
I'm just trying to think of how was there a change in attitude, I guess, of the people there, that it's going to be a shooting war, and that I'm trying to think of people on course, because a lot of times I gather courses are place to mark some time more than anything else, for some.
Mm.
Not for all, but for some it's a place to mark time, whereas I guess they have to take more interest. That this really is going to be important, and it might just be that it saves me personally. Or is that carrying it too far?
Maybe. I think we all felt that the war was bound to come, that it was coming. And I suppose what we were doing was going to be important. The knowledge we were absorbing, so to speak, might be useful.
Mm-hmm. Now, you went in, with the war happening in September, you're still on course. Now, what do the Canadians tell you to do?
Stay on the course. Actually, I wish I'd kept it, because I was actually on leave when war was declared. And I got a telegram saying, general mobilization, stay on leave. I thought that rather struck me as rather amusing. I must say, we're mobilizing everybody else, but we don't want
you. Who sent you? The British or the Canadians?
That's Canadian.
They tell you not to go anywhere or do anything for the first week, or because you were on leave, they didn't have to worry about you.
No, just because I then knew I was coming back anyway. I mean, I knew.
Do you want to get back to Canada then? Get back into the regiment, or?
I would have liked to, but there was no way. I said, oh, no way. We let you go now. We want you on these various technical jobs.
How long did you think the war would last?
Oh.
Excuse me.
No idea.
It was going to be over at Christmas, though.
No, I don't think there was any feeling. No, there was no feeling of that sort.
No repeat of the first one.
No. I think it looked never ending at times. I began to wonder if it ever was going to end.
You continued on with your course. I guess you're going to get the start of the Battle of Britain coming your way as well. Or is that more later, 40-41, I guess?
It was more later, I think.
Yeah.
You see, it was, it brought us to 1939, 1940. Then I stayed, I came back to Canada in April 1940. There was an interim there when they were setting up CMHQ in London, and I was attached to that when after the course.
Mm-hmm. Promoted then, or?
No, I was still the captain. And then I came back to Ottawa on, they had so many different names, I think they called it the Directorate of Technical Research in those days. And I came back to that, where I was for, I don't remember just how long, nearly a year, I guess. And then I went over to England with old General Worthington. I don't know if you know who he is or have heard of him.
Name sounds familiar.
Well, he was a great armored corps. He was originally PPCLI, First War. And then he started the armored corps in Canada, and he was a great believer in armor. And a very far-seeing man. And we were starting then to build the Ram tank in Montreal, and there was a question of what armament to put in it. And I was sent over with...
This would be when you were working out of Ottawa,
yes,
right?
Yes, I was working out of Ottawa. This would be the spring of 42, I guess. And so I was sent over with Worthington and an engineer from Montreal. Three of us went over to look at gun mounts and guns, etc. And at that time, they had a two-pounder gun in the tanks. And I remember old Worthington saying, this is absolute nonsense. They should go at least to a 17-pounder. And they were going to a 6-pounder in the British tanks at this time. And of course it was much too small. The Germans had gone to their 88mm, which is about the equivalent of a 17-pounder. And our portable 2-pounders and 6-pounders wouldn't touch the German tanks.
Yeah.
However, then that was sort of over, eh? And Andy McNaughton said to me one day, he said, look, how about I'd like you to go to the Ordnance Board, which was in England then and down in Chislehurst, just south of London, for a while. They want somebody on their ballistics department.
Oh, is this when you were in Ottawa or in London itself?
This is I was in London itself.
At London HQ.
Yeah. And so I went there, and I was there for nearly a year, I guess. Then I came back to Ottawa again as director of artillery. And then in 43, I managed to work my way back to England and to Army headquarters. And I was there for 2 or 3 months. And then they organized this, what they call the Weapons Technical Staff Field Forces, which was an adjunct of 21 Army Group. And I went to that. That was a mixed unit with Brits and ourselves. It was a Canadian section of it.
And promoted still, or still?
No, I was a lieutenant colonel by now. Well, I had been a colonel. I'd been a full colonel when I was in Ottawa. But I dropped down a rank to go back to...
Well, hold on. What did you make majors? What I'm asking you. See, we've missed one here. Did you ever make majors?
Yeah. I guess I made major just after I got back to Canada the first time. And then, let me think, when did I get Lieutenant Colonel? That came in somewhere.
By the time you were in Ottawa?
Yeah. Then I was major, that's right. And then I was a major when I went over with Worthington. And as I left the Ordnance Board, I got Lieutenant Colonel. That was it. Then I came back to Ottawa as Lieutenant Colonel. And then was made a colonel.
Acting or full?
Full colonel. And then I went down to lieutenant colonel again to go back overseas. They said, we haven't got a job for full colonel. And I said, well, I don't care. I want to go back overseas. I'm tired of Ottawa.
You have to go back down.
Yeah, I went down. And that often happened in the war. Mm-hmm. People went up and down on things. So then I went back to Army for a while as lieutenant colonel, and then to this Wheat Chief organization. Wheat Chief, it was called. Nickname the WTSFF.
This would be a Supreme Allied Command type of thing with Heinz 57s for forces.
Well,
Canadian and British.
Just Canadian and British. That's all we were looking after, or all we were dealing with. We didn't deal with the Americans at all. We'd had some dealings with the Poles once, the Polish division, because that was under our command at the time. But that was a funny little organization. It wasn't very large.
Now, we're talking what date here?
We're talking now 43.
We're talking 43 when you get back. And the Poles were a pretty small division, didn't they?
No, the Poles were later. No, the Poles were later. Yeah, they're out there in the... Belgium, I think, the first one I saw them. So that was much later.
Okay.
So now where are we?
We're 43.
This is late 43.
Maybe preparing for the invasion itself, is that correct?
Yes, that's now underway. The preparations for that are underway at this point.
How much information did you have at that time?
Not much. We were involved essentially with the weaponry.
Just the weaponry?
We had one rather amusing incident. These mulberry things, you know, that they towed across these great big concrete things. And there were two or three of them down in Portsmouth Harbor, and somebody got the bright idea. I said, what happens? And they had the 40mm air-cack guns on them. And somebody got the bright idea at HQ 21 Army Group, but supposing these sink not quite level, what are you going to do with those guns? Because they can't be leveled. So we were called in, and I was sent with another chap. We went off down to look at one of these things. Climb all the way up there on the ground in Portsmouth Harbor, I think it was. And look at the gun and say, well, how are they going to be leveled? So we obviously did the simplest by putting three leveling screws. So then we came back to 21 Army Group and said, well, this is the answering. And they said, oh, good, let's get on with it. And I said, how many guns are you going to have? Judge Wolf can't tell it down. And I said, well, silly, I can't tell the fact that you just go on turning out screws by the million. You've got to know how many are going to be made. This new stride got to be told how many to make. So eventually, go figure on a piece of paper and quickly put it into the fire. So I multiplied it by three and added a few odd bits on and said, well, they'll need X thousand bolts. Which they did. And produced these so that they could level the rest of the guns. Nobody thought of it early enough. That was the first thing I was involved in, the real planning of the invasion. Apart from looking after the guns themselves.
That's incredible. So they just, it was still hush-hush secret. There's a half-colonel involved with headquarters.
Yeah.
Forget it.
Yeah. OS
need-to-know basis right down the line.
Yeah, yeah.
Even then you had to prove it.
Yes, you sure did, yes. They were very, security was very tight in those days. In some ways, well, I suppose in all ways, we tried to keep it. I mean, you could see, anybody with their eyes could see the build-up going on in the UK, especially as it got on into 44, and the whole side of England was just an armed camp, practically. The roads, you couldn't move on the roads hardly. You'd suddenly find an armed division coming trotting along gently. You know, and that sort of thing, you could hardly move.
Now, your specific task at this time is to plan for what? Weapon systems, is that correct?
Our job was to see that the weapon systems were working correctly. And if they were not, we could go direct to any branch of the Ministry of Supply, design, manufacturing, or what have you, and say, look, this is wrong and must be fixed. In other words, we circumvented all the normal channels through the command channels, up to the War Office, across to the Ministry of Supply, and down through their channels.
You just cut the red, you were red.
We just went straight to whoever was involved. We worked for both Ministry of Supply and War Office, 21 Army Group, or any other unit that wanted us. We could go to and see and talk to. We had passes which let us go anywhere in the Army Group area.
That would be 21 Army Group.
Yeah, and then we also had chafe passes which allowed us to go anywhere. When that was formed, the Supreme Headquarters formed and was in Europe, we could go anywhere in that area. But we didn't very much because we stayed pretty well now in 21 Army Group area because they were the ones we were dealing with.
What type of problems did you face, I guess, you come up with?
Well, the first one that I ran into was one of the RAJ regiments killing their gun crews with loading tray premature. In other words, they were loading the shell and it went off and killed the gun crew, naturally. And I was sent off to look at this one and see what what was the matter.
Did you stand back and go ahead and load it, or what?
Yeah, well, that's all you could do. You had to go and watch. And these RAJ regiments were very smart and they prided themselves on being very quick with the loading their gun, etc. And I watched them doing a shoot. Nothing happened on this particular shoot. I got the idea that they were loading it too quickly. And I said to the CO, I said, now look, I think what is happening is that they try and have the gun loaded and ready to fire as soon as it's run out. You know, the coil runs out back into its position. That's what's called right. Run out. And they have to have closed, breech closed and ready to fire as soon as the gun's in the firing position again. And I said, I think that's wrong, because I have a feeling that the gun on its, they're loading the round while the gun is still recoiling and they're hitting the breech with the nose of the shell. Now, admittedly, the fuse is supposed to be designed that it can take a bang and it has a shutter in it and it won't transmit the flash of the detonator fires to the main filling. That's what I suspect. Somehow, when it hits like that, that shutter is deformed or bent or something, and that fires the detonator and the shell goes off. So I suggest you don't let them do this, because there's no need for it. They're not firing at that rate of speed. No need for them to do that. And he agreed, and he said, all right, we'll try it. And so they did, and they never had any more. So I suspect that's what it was.
They were loading so quickly.
So quickly that the gun was still recoiling when they were trying to put the shell in.
Why, they're trying to cram the next one in.
Yeah. I suspect something like that had happened. It shouldn't, I mean, but after all, you can only design so much safety into a thing that is designed to blow up and kill.
Yeah.
You can't guard against every contingency. And then another awful problem we had was with the 5.5 guns. They were having premises in the bore. And we never really did. We suspected it was a Mazak fuse, which was a zinc alloy fuse, was cranking. Eventually, we got rid of those fuses. We couldn't get rid of them once. We hadn't got any others. There weren't any others in the theater.
So where was it going off now? In
the bore of the gun.
After it was fired?
Yeah. You fired it, and the shell blew up in the bore of the gun. Well, sometimes it would kill the odd people round about somewhere, maybe. Sometimes it just, I mean, the barrel just peeled right back.
Just peeling the barrel, man.
Yeah.
Just crap and garbage flying out in every
direction
at the other end.
Yeah, all round about.
Oh.
And then it was either that or the exploder bag in the shell getting broken and grains of the stuff getting into the thread of the fuse. So that when the shock of discharge squashed those little grains and they went off and started the thing going. I still think it was the fuse itself, though, that certain type of fuse which we got rid of in the end, and that seemed to stop them eventually. Then another problem I had one time in the winter, and again I never found out the real answer, was with the 25-pounder blowing its breech off. And again, killing two or three chaps. I mean, the breech just comes flying back off the gun.
Straight off.
And this one particular regiment, it was an RA regiment, had about three of them. And they were getting very worried, needless to say. And we never, and I said, are you sure they didn't leave extra exploder bags in or charges? And they swore they hadn't. And I said, what about a little ice in the bores? This was in winter and it was cold. And the gun sergeants, the numbers one, all swore that the barrels were all clear, but I still think there could be ice in it, which would cause the shell to stop and the pressure to build up enough
to slow down, yeah.
And cold, and the metal would be cold and possibly a little brittle, and it would break and come out. We had a 6-inch gun do it. Nobody was hurt. It blew it down and on by 20 feet in the ground. It was a full elevation at the time.
God,
but that didn't hurt anyone. That was the only one that did it. And that killed me. Oh, you get other little funny things that happen. One of our own regiments was complaining bitterly about getting a lot of misfires. Again, it's in the winter and cold weather. And the CO happened to be a friend of mine anyway, and I said, well, what do they do with the strikers? I said, obviously, it's not striking the shell properly. He said, oh, they take the oil off or they don't take it off or what have you. And I said, well, tell them just to take the strikers out and just tuck it in their battle dress when they're not firing. And they never had any more trouble. It was just the oil congealing, you know, and the striker would get stiff and the action would be slow. And instead of doing that to the thing, it sort of did that, and therefore wouldn't set it off. Little yeah. things. So those are the sort of the type of things we ran into a lot of the time.
Compounded by a whole army group's worth of artillery.
Yeah.
What about tanks? Now, would you be responsible for
tanks? No, we weren't responsible. I wasn't responsible for tanks.
Self-propelled
guns? That was an AFV Tech, which was another organization paralleling ours, very similar, but their job was tanks. We had, we self-propelled artillery were involved in.
Maybe with the Priest and the SP?
Yeah, and the 25-pounder SP and the 17-pounder anti-tank SP. That was when we had a problem with the CO of this regiment said, look, we're getting too many people getting killed with splinters and stuff from overhead. So we designed a little cover, just a steel plate across the top, open sort of around the edges, but just a steel plate over the top. And had that put on all the 17-pounder SPs, which helped them.
Considerably, I guess.
Anyway, they were much happier.
So this would, I guess, take up virtually all of your time from 44 to June, I guess, from the beginning of 44
yes.
right up to June.
Yeah, it did.
Just continue working on problems and making sure the weapon systems, artillery systems, weren't weapons.
Yeah.
Artillery systems were working.
We had, with this unit, we also had an organization that looked after small arms as well. We had rifles and Sten guns and those sort of things. I didn't bother with those.
Was there any manufacturing deficiencies, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at, is because of the increase in productivity and cranking this stuff out for the boys, was there shoddy workmanship or poor materials that caught you short on the other end?
I would say on the whole, no. I think the inspection systems were pretty good. Would it be the odd thing, I suppose, but I can't think of any at the moment. I remember particularly.
I mean, guns weren't peeling back on their first shell or anything like that. Their shells were actually.
I mean, possibly those punctures were due to bad manufacturing. I don't know. Some of them could have been. And you get the odd round that didn't go as far as it should have gone because something wasn't quite right, perhaps, in the cartridge. But on the whole, I think the manufacturing was pretty good, in spite of the speed ups.
What happens is, I'm going to have to take a pause here, is what I'm going to do. Well, we're back. Next day, we'll continue on with D-Day. You're being seconded to a British unit, and continuing on in France, and finish off the war.
Okay.
Thank you very much, sir.
Bye-bye.